لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله العلي العظيم حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير فأعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الحمد لله الذي هدانا لهذا وما كنا لنهتدي لولا أن هدانا الله والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء وسيد المرسلين وشفيع المذنبين سيدنا ونبينا وحبيب قلوبنا وطبيب نفوسنا وشفيع ذنوبنا أبي القاسم محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعلى آل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين المظلومين المنتجبين لا سيما مولانا وسيدي صاحب الأصل والزمان روحي وأرواح العالمين له الفداء وأجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف ولعنة دائمة على أعدائهم ومنكر فضائلهم للآن إلى قيام يوم الدين أما بعد رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري وحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي For the hastening of the return of our 12th Imam, the one who will avenge the Shuhada of Karbala, Imam al-Hujjah, one salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. My dear brothers and sisters in Iman, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We first off begin by extending our condolences to the 12th Imam, Imam al-Hujjah, and to all of us who are here this evening as we continue in the commemoration of the tragedy of Karbala. And the fact is that we don't only stop at the day of Ashura. Obviously, the day of Ashura was the pinnacle of the tragedy of what happened to the family of the Prophet. And not only what happened to the family of the Prophet, but what happened to the religion of Islam. But as a community, we, as a tradition, gather on these milestones after Ashura all the way up to the day of Arba'in. And so the 10th day, 10 days after Muharram, as is tonight we are gathering, on the 20th we'll gather again, the 30th we'll also congregate. And then as we know, the Arba'in, the Chelum, the 40th day after Ashura, is where that massive congregation takes place, where the millions of the lovers of Aba Abdullah will walk on foot, some barefoot, from not only Najaf, but from the farthest remote locations of Iraq, to pay their respects to Aba Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam. And in doing so, those believers who have been given this opportunity will recreate that event where Jabir and his companion Atiyah and the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, where they arrived on the day of Arba'in to Karbala. And so as we begin this continued season of mourning for the next at least 30 days, if not more, we again offer our condolences to the brothers and sisters, and we ask Allah to put us in the camp of those lovers and followers of Aba Abdullah al-Hussein alayhi salam. We ask Allah that if we have the tawfiq, that we are given the opportunity this year to make it to Arba'in, to the grave of Sayyid al-Shuhada. And if for some reason our fate is not written to go this year, we ask Allah to give us the tawfiq to make it next year to Aba Abdullah. For the fulfillment of all of our hajat, for us to be able to make it to Karbala, one salawat upon Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. For these series that we have tonight, and then on the 20th, and then on the 30th of Karbala, I want to bring up a topic on a theme that is something which resonates amongst all of us for multiple reasons. I want to look at the topic of La'an, of what we call the malediction or sending the curses on the killers who are responsible for Karbala. And to better understand this concept from a humanistic perspective, from the Quran, and then more specifically from the Ziyarat of Ashura, this becomes an issue always at the time of Muharram at two different levels or segments of the Muslim community. What do I mean? At one level, we have people who are outside of the teachings of Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam. They may be Muslims, but they don't subscribe to our understanding of Islam as taught by Prophet and his noble family. And every time the month of Muharram rolls around, and we don the black, and we begin to lament on the tragedy of Karbala, one of the prime accusations that comes against us, the followers of Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam, is that you are a community that curse the companions of Rasulullah. I'm sure we've heard this many times. We've probably seen it on social media. Maybe we have friends of other denominations within Islam that accuse us of cursing all of the Sahaba. Obviously, that is an erroneous statement, and we will try to correct it in this series of three discussions. But that's just one of the aspects that we as a community have to deal with, that we are accused of reviling and disrespecting people that other Muslims have high honor and esteem for. But the other aspect also is as troubling as the first group, and those are people within the fold of the teachings of Ahlul Bayt, the Shia of Ali alayhi salam. And those are people within our midst today, in our societies, in our communities. And they put forth this belief that they say that why do we involve ourselves in La'nat? Why do we curse certain individuals in Ziyarat Ashura as an example? Why do we not just invoke love and prayers on Ali Muhammad? Why do we go to the extent of disrespecting, of putting under the microscope, of analyzing from a historical perspective certain individuals that the Prophet maybe was silent about? This is a double-edged attack, as we can see. On one end, it's people who don't follow our ideology. And so at one level, they can be excused because they are not aware of the intricacies of Karbala and the tragedy and what happened on that day and what also precipitated what led up to the event of Karbala. But the second group becomes more of a challenge because these are individuals who are presumably knowing of the history of Ali Muhammad. They know of the pre-Islamic history. They know what Rasulullah went through 23 years. They have heard, they have read, they have studied about Karbala. They know what the situation was like amongst certain individuals around Rasulullah. And yet they come with this accusation or this rebuttal that we should not revile certain individuals. Who are we to pass judgment on certain people? Who are we to speak bad of individuals in history? Let Allah deal with everybody. We should focus on love and ourselves and our self-building and let Allah deal with those who were responsible for certain crimes. Inshallah, in this series of three talks, I want to try and dispel both sides of the accusations to give us as well understanding of where we fit in the whole ethos of the event of Karbala. Because whether we like it or not, Karbala did not happen in a vacuum. It was not an event that happened in the year 61 after the Hijra, 1370 some odd years ago, and now it is a book or an event that is relegated to the books of history. It is very much alive today. The lessons that we have to learn from the tragedy of Karbala, the characters that were involved and the traits that they possessed which made them do what they did on the day of Ashura are still very alive in the world today. And if we don't understand the entire synopsis and have an understanding of the situation, then we risk falling into the same category as those who were there in Karbala. We can't forget that we have a 12th Imam, a living Imam of our time. And if we do not understand the concept of La'an, of this malediction of praying to Allah to remove His mercy from certain individuals, because of traits that they possessed, we risk the same fate that those who were responsible for Karbala faced on that particular day. And so we want to try and dissect this topic in three different lessons or three different sessions. Tonight I want to just briefly introduce the topic and look at the general understanding of love and hate in Islam. How do we understand this concept or these concepts of love and hate within the ethos of our religion? In our next discussion, I want to look at the Quranic perspective of love and hate. Does Allah actually speak about these concepts? And if He does, what wording does Allah use? Does Allah really love and hate? We talked about this many months ago about Allah's emotions, and He doesn't go into emotional states as you and I do. So how do we understand Allah loving people? As He says in the Quran, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يُحِبُّ For example, Allah loves certain people, and Allah talks about people that He has a dislike for or a hatred for. How do we understand such concepts when Allah does not go through emotional, you know, states of love and hate? And we'll look at that and see how the Quran speaks about it. And then in our last discussion, I want to look directly at Ziyarat Ashura, and especially those contentious lines where we invoked the damnation, the curse of certain people, where we ask Allah for Him to remove His select mercy from certain individuals. How do we understand that in the light of the event of Karbala, in the context of who is mentioned in Ziyarat Ashura? And we'll mention names because they're there in the Ziyarat, and we'll try to understand their direct role in what happened on the day of Ashura. And we will try to come full circle for us to understand what our responsibility is 1360 some odd years after the tragedy of Karbala. Salu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. So first off, one of the questions that is maybe on the forefront of our mind is there room in religion for love and hate? You know, we live in a society today where it's full of contradictions. Many different contradictions exist in democracy versus religion and many of the things that happen in the world. When you look at certain religions today in the world, they tell us that we are a religion of love. Our God is a religion of love. That they emanate love, they teach love, they promote love in society. And sometimes these same religious groups will point the finger at us as Muslims and say that your God is a vengeful God. He kills, He destroys, He annihilates, He condemns people to the fire of hell. And sometimes we maybe are left to question, how do we understand our Islam? Is it such that Allah is not a loving God? Does God have a hateful side to Him, using their language? What we have to understand, and hopefully we'll try to develop this also in our next discussion, is that Islam is a religion of reality. Islam is a religion where it looks at every aspect of the human, every aspect of the society. We can use love and hate as terms. You can put it as like or dislike, as affection and aversion. But we realize that even in the world that we live in today, we don't love everything. We don't have a closeness to everything. Nobody would say that they love to be stung by a bee or a wasp. Nobody wants that. Nobody would say that they love to go into a high-speed accident and be in the hospital. Those are things that we don't like. We hate those certain things. If we can use a similar concept of not liking certain things because of the effect on us, like a bee sting, like a wasp, like an accident, then at a metaphysical level, at a spiritual level, we can look at it in the same way. Because when we look at love and hate in Islam, it's not about personal grudge or vendetta. It's about connection to Allah and what Allah wants us to be close to and what He wants us to be away from. And so when Rasulullah was asked this question, how do you define religion? And this is a hadith which is found in all the Muslim books. The Shias and the Sunnis quote this hadith, that Rasulullah was asked about religion. How do you define this faith of Islam? He was clear to say the following. He says that religion can be founded on this principle, or the best portion of faith, the best definition of faith, of iman, is where you love for the sake of Allah, and where you hate for the sake of Allah. Islam is a religion, again, of practicality, of rationalism. We realize that we can't love the killer and the one who was killed. You cannot hate, or you cannot love the rapist and the woman or person who was raped. You can't hate somebody, or you can't love somebody who is guilty of crimes and love those who he was also guilty of inflicting the crime upon. To do so would just be irrational. It would mean that we don't have a criminal code. Because if you don't have hatred for the crime or the criminal, why have a system of a court? Why have a prison system? Why have a system in the world where you penalize people who do crimes against humanity. It wouldn't make sense. You would say, well, we have to love everybody. Love the killer, let him live his life. Because to put him in jail is a vicious act. It's not love for that individual. So logic even will dictate, if we think about this, that love and hate have to be within religion for human beings, for you and I, to function within a society. But if you look at the definition, you see that iman, faith, is built on love and hate, but it's for the sake of Allah. In our teachings, the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, we are told that our love and hate is channeled based on what Allah expects from us. So all of our love is geared towards those whom Allah wants us to love. Those actions which Allah wants us to perform. That becomes our criteria. That association that we have is because of the love that Allah has to certain individuals. And the disavowal or disassociation based on the same, on what Allah expects from us. One of the things, however, that we have to understand is that love and hate, because they're two emotions that we have, they're two parts of our being, which are really many times inseparable from us, they take part or they take effect or shape in our lives at different levels. I would say in three different levels. Level one is where we have love and hate, but based on our own personal life, on our own personal actions. As an example, we have a hadith from Rasulullah, the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. In which Rasulullah has been quoted as saying, "The rubba tali al-Quran wal-Quranu yal'anuhu." That many times there are people who read the Quran and the Quran is cursing them. The Quran is making la'nat on the reader of the Quran. Now how could that be? How can a Muslim read the Quran and the Quran is cursing the Muslim? It goes back to love and hate and at that very first level of our application of Islam. Allah says in the Quran, for example, that Allah sends His la'nat, His curses, on the people who are liars, who are transgressors, people who go against the rules of Allah, people who drink alcohol, who go in terms of illicit relationships, people who are involved in haram. If I am performing any of those actions and I'm reading the Quran, I am sealing my own fate because Allah tells me Allah doesn't love those who commit crimes and yet I'm doing them. So rather than me gaining proximity to Allah, I'm actually distancing myself from the Quran and from Allah because I am doing things which are not permitted of me. So a level one at the pinnacle is where we reform our own character, where we know the prohibitions, we know the obligations, and we follow accordingly. Number two, however, is where we associate and disavow from people who are breaking the rules of Allah. And so obviously that means that we need to know Islam. We need to learn the Quran. We need to study it. We need to see where does Allah bring this trait of love and hate. And look for those traits within people that we want to associate with. And see that do they have the traits of love that Allah wants. If they do, then we follow them. If they don't, it's simple that we keep away from those individuals. And the third, and the maybe the most simplest, which is what we want to look at in these series, is a verbal declaration. The most simplest of ways of disavowing ourselves from people, such as the killers of Sayyid al-Shuhada, is through our verbal declaration. It's to attest to it through the tongue. You know, we see this even in the world today. You know, sometimes when you watch television, you'll see they'll have these infomercials, half an hour, 45 minute infomercial, but right before the infomercial comes on TV, they'll have a small footnote, they'll have a note, they'll say that the views expressed in this program, for example, do not, they're not in line with the television station or the sponsors or the television show that you're about to watch. So that commercial is being paid as a paid advertisement. It has nothing to do with a TV station. They're just buying airtime to promote their product. The TV station, the owners have nothing to do with it. Lanat in the ziyarat is a similar concept where we are showing that we do not agree with the actions of certain individuals. And again, the simplest way to do that, if we're not at that level of not performing the actions ourselves or keeping away from those people, we don't have that ability yet, is that we at least verbally declare that we are not wanting to be associated with those who are guilty of certain crimes. And so ultimately, this is the minimal that we should be able to display in our lives, that we have an aversion on the tongue, which stems from the heart, that we do not want to be associated with certain individuals and their actions. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. But within the Muslim world today, we have literally three different opinions of how do we understand this love and hate. At the very top, we have Muslims today who literally say that love everybody and hate nobody. Love everybody, everything in the world, and don't talk about hate, don't talk about dislike. Just to have love for everyone. Overcome anger, you know, hatred, animosity, just through your power of love. And it sounds beautiful, it sounds very interesting. But as I mentioned in the beginning, when you look at it at a practical level, it becomes very difficult to enact this within our day-to-day life. To love everybody unconditionally. That's just one extreme of the emotions. And again, we don't see that in our day-to-day life. People do not love everyone or everything in the world. At the other end of the spectrum, you have those who will tell us that we have no right to critique or criticize people who were around Rasulullah, or those who came after the companions, or those who claimed any level of Islam. They say that these are all people, they did ijtihad, maybe they were right, maybe they were wrong, we let Allah judge them. That's one other complete extreme within the Muslim society today, and that makes up the majority of the Muslim ummah as we speak. But then we have a middle ground which is given to us by the Ahlul Bayt alayhum as-salam, obviously based on the Quran and the teachings of Rasulullah, that we as Muslims, not only are we allowed to, but we are obligated to define and to understand where our loyalties and allegiances lie. If that were not the case, it would be redundant for Allah to give us the example of Pharaoh, of Pharaon in the Quran. Allah could have said, well, you know, Pharaoh is a bad man. He killed all the males. He made the women go into slavery. He claimed to be God. But you know what? Don't judge him, because we don't know what was in his heart. If we were not allowed to judge people based on their outward actions, then people like Pharaoh, like Haman, like Satan, Iblis, we would not be allowed to even curse him. But yet we all say, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ. We ask Allah to remove and to keep us away from shaitan. If we don't have the right to judge, then all of these stories of the Quran become redundant. The prophets and their adversaries become just useless stories that we just read to put our children to bed at night as a little story. They don't give us anything that we can transform our lives with. But we know that the Quran was sent to be a transformative book, to revolutionize our thinking, our actions, our way of life, to be able to judge society from the outward, because we don't know what's in people's hearts, but we judge based on the Quran as the Furqan and based on the actions of the individuals. So we say that the middle path is the way to go. We don't condemn, and as Shias of the followers of Ahlul Bayt, we do not condemn all of the companions. It's impossible to. If you figure the minimal definition of a companion, of a Sahaba of Rasulullah, was somebody who was a Muslim, who even saw the Prophet for a brief minute, that is a companion. We have over 100,000 companions listed in the books. Now we know that we do not ask Allah to remove His mercy from all of those. We have a certain list of people that we are critical of, based on historical information that we have read in the books, based on their own conduct and their own methods of how they dealt with the Prophet and the family and the respected other companions. And so we say that we do not disrespect all of the companions. We have concern with certain individuals for certain reasons, which we can then discuss and come to an understanding of why we, as the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim wassalam, why we have certain problems with certain individuals. So coming to the point for tonight is this issue of Karbala and Ziyarat Ashura, because this will be our prime focus for the next 3 nights, and obviously as a community up until 9th of Rabiul Awwal. So for the next 2 months and 10 days, obviously our entire lives will be concerned about Karbala. Our centers will continue to be covered in black. Our clothing will be representation of the grief that we are in. And so we obviously need to better understand where we fit in to the revolution of Sayyid al-Shuhada. And so I say that love and hate, these two emotions, when they are understood in the relation of the Quran, when they are understood as being tied to what Allah expects from us, when we understand His history of pre-Karbala, post-Karbala, this gives us the starting point of where we can begin to better understand the concept of La'an, this concept of removing the mercy, of asking Allah to remove His mercy from key individuals who were responsible for crimes against the greatest of people of humanity, that being our third Imam, Imam Hussein ibn Ali, alayhi wassalatu wassalam. Let me try and wrap this up in the next few minutes, that without knowing the history of certain people, obviously the Ziyarat of Ashura becomes very static. We can't really appreciate why are we saying, for example, in the latter part, where we say, Allahumma al-an Aba Sufyan wa Muawiyah wa Yazid ibn Muawiyah. Why do we ask Allah to remove His mercy from Abu Sufyan, from Muawiyah, from Yazid the son of Muawiyah? Why do we ask Allah to remove His blessings from Banu Umayyah, from Banu Abbas, from Umar ibn Sa'ad, ibn Marjana? Why do we ask Allah for all of these? Now obviously I'm not going to go into the detailed biographies tonight, but just think about few of these people and their role in Karbala. Yazid, obviously, la'natullah alayh, he needs no introduction. He's a man whom, although he wasn't there physically in Karbala on Ashura, but yet we know that he is responsible because he was the so-called Khalifa. He claimed to be the representation or the representative of Allah on this earth. Khalifatullah, as the Bani Umayyah would take on this title. It wasn't just Khalifatul Rasulullah, it was now Khalifatullah, the representative of Allah. And his family, you can study them. Muawiyah, for example, Abu Sufyan, they literally became Muslims 2 years before the death of Rasulullah. When Fath of Makkah happens, we know that Islam, that Rasulullah lives for 23 years as the Prophet. 21 years after the message begins, Abu Sufyan and the few people come into Islam. 2 years they are with the Prophet in Makkah, some in Medina. Some people claim it was longer, but our historians say that no, it was a maximum of 2 years. You're talking about people for 21 years were staunchly opposed to Islam, who were ready to shed the blood of Rasulullah wherever they could find him. How do they change their persona in a few years to now be worthy of being leaders of the community? Not only Abu Sufyan, but his entire family. Muawiyah was no different. His son Yazid, the hadith tell us, Muslims narrate that he was one who was an open drinker of alcohol. He killed innocent people. He engaged in actions that I can't even mention off the minbar. Things that are so vile that historians, probably their pens shake when they write of what kind of a man Yazid was. You have a man like that at the helm of Islamic society at that time. And then you look at people who were under him. People like his governor, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, who was so known in society that he's known in Ziyarat Ashura as two names, Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad. He's also known as Ibn Marjan, the son of a woman named Marjana. And if you put two and two together, you can figure out why he has two names. Nobody knew who his real father was because of the profession that his mother had at that time. So you have a man like that who's the governor of the city of Kufa, the stronghold of Islam at that time. What are his general? Umar ibn Sa'd ibn Abi al-Waqqas. Sa'd ibn Abi al-Waqqas, a prominent companion of Rasulullah. He became one of the first converts. He was, according to some historians, the 17th person who comes into Islam at the age of about 17 or 18. He has some issues in history. I don't want to go into that. But his son, who was promised the governorship of a little town in south of Tehran called Ray, which at that time was probably nothing on the map, he is ready to shed the blood of the son, the grandson of Rasulullah, for the governorship of a small, tiny village, which is, you know, nobody even cared about it at that time. So again, a very intriguing personality that we have to understand in order to better understand the context of Ziyarat Ashura. We obviously have the army of Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, of Umar ibn Sa'd, the 30,000 plus soldiers, the people of Kufa who were not loyal to the message of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam. So on one level you have all of these people. And again, to understand why we have the la'nat, we need to go through their biographies, which we will try to go over in the nights to come. But then on the other hand, you have a man like Sayyid al-Shuhada, a man who his brother was the imam, Ma'sum. His father is a Ma'sum. His mother is a Ma'suma. His grandfather is the messenger of Allah. A man who was brought up in the house of Nubuwa. A child, when he was a baby, where the angels would come and comfort Imam Hassan and Hussein alayhi wasalam, where the angels would come and, you know, protect these children, where the angels would be there to speak. You have a man like that who stands on the opposite side of people who are only Muslims because their blood was maybe on the line at the Fath of Mecca. And you see what small army he has. We've heard the narrative of Karbala, 72 or maybe 112 people killed on Ashura. And why do we praise them and we curse the other side? Obviously, when we study these individuals and their biography, it will hopefully make a bit more sense of why this concept of La'an is within our teachings. Let me conclude with this last point, which is that the Quran tells us in chapter 17, Surah Bani Israel, verse 84, why certain people act in a certain way. Allah says, قُلْ say, O Rasulullah, to the people, that everybody acts according to their own disposition, what they are like human beings inside their soul. كُلُّ يَعْمَلُ عَلَى شَاكِلَتِهِ. This shakila, this way that we are, our characteristics, our traits, they come from multiple sources. We know that a lot of our traits are hereditary, and this is why the hadith tell us when you want to marry somebody, look at that person. If they're an alcoholic, they're doing drugs, don't marry your daughter to such a person. Maybe he's cleaned up, maybe not. Be careful of who you marry, because the traits of the family will go into the children. So the hereditary traits are very important. But also the upbringing, the nurturing, the tarbiyah, that also becomes an important trait, or an important factor rather, in how our traits are formed. And who we live around, who we interact with. And so when we look at Karbala, we see that those who are responsible, whether it be Yazid, his governors, his generals, his minion of army, these are all people that when we study them, they had a very bad lineage where they came from. I mean, if your mother or grandmother is one who would chew the liver of the uncle of Prophet, you're not a good person. You're not going to have a good upbringing, definitely. When you live in an environment where you're full of illicit activities like Yazid was, how do you expect him to now turn out? To be an angel? To be a prince, a savior of humanity? Of course not. And when you associate with people who are of ill repute, you get people like Hurmala, like all of these guilty people who were guilty and charged and were sentenced because of their actions on the day of Ashura. صلوا على محمد وآل محمد. And as I conclude for tonight, where we look at this concept of la'an, and we understand, at least at this initial level, that when we ask Allah and we say, Allahumma al'an, for example, awwala dhalimin, dhalamu haqqa Muhammad wa ali Muhammad, O Allah, remove your blessings and mercy from the first one who took away the rights of Muhammad and ali Muhammad, and we continue in that ziyarat. It's not out of emotion we do this. It's not because we have a grudge or a vendetta with the people who were responsible for Karbala. It was because, as we read in Ziyarat Ashura, that they perpetrated the greatest, severest crime that has ever been inflicted, and that the angels and humanity have been crying over since that tragic day. Brothers and sisters, as I conclude, I take us back to the day of Ashura. That tragic day on the 10th of Muharram, just 10 short days ago, where we were here lamenting the tragedy of Abu Abdullah alayhi salam. You know, when Abu Abdullah on the day of Ashura, after all of the family members had been killed, after all of his companions had gone to the battlefield only to lose their lives, we were left on the day of Ashura where Imam Hussein is left all alone. He looks at one side of the tents and the ladies. Lady Zainab alayhi salam, Hazrat Rubab is there, the women of the tent, the women of the family are in one tent, the young children are in the tent. He looks at one of the other tents and he knows his son Zainul Abideen is in the other tent lying sick. He knows that with Lady Rubab that his six-month-old Ali Asghar is with him, with her. And we know that historically, at one point Abu Abdullah is given something in his hands. It's not the mother Rubab who comes to Imam Hussein, but rather it's the sister Lady Zainab. Lady Zainab comes to Abu Abdullah on the day of Ashura with a little package. It's a small little package. And she comes to Abu Abdullah, she says to her brother, she says, oh my dear brother, he says that your six-month-old son, Ali al-Asghar, this young boy, Abdullah, he's dying of the thirst. He's dying from thirst from being in this desert for so many days. Do you think you could take him to the enemy? Maybe they'll have some compassion and mercy for this young child. As Abu Abdullah takes the young Hazrat Ali Asghar, he's covered in cloth. Historians say that Imam Hussein wrapped him up in cloth to protect him from the heat of the day of Ashura. When we read the books of history, we're told that Harmala mentions one thing to Mukhtar. That Harmala told Mukhtar, when Mukhtar asked him that, why did you kill that child, or how did you know what was going to happen? Harmala tells Mukhtar, he says that whenever Hussein wanted to come and try to initiate a war, a battle, he would ride his horse. Anytime he came that he wanted to give us admonition and wise counsel, he would come on his camel. But one time on the day of Ashura, he came walking on his own 2 feet, and he was holding something in his hands. Historians say that as Imam Hussein came closer and closer to the enemy forces, he opened up the cloth that he was covering, and the enemy forces saw that it was a six-month-old child. At first, Imam Hussein addressed the enemies on the right side of the army. Then he began to tell them that if you have a problem with the old men and the adults of my army, of my camp, then what crime has the young children and the young babies of this camp done? He says, if you think that, you know, this water will give us any benefit, then come and give the child some water. Come and give this little six-month-old baby some water. As they began to cry, Imam Hussein then turns to the left side of the army. He addresses the left side and he tells the same things to them. He then looks at the middle of the army forces and he begins to also appeal to their emotional sentiment. Historians say that the enemy forces are broken up into 3 different groups. They're confused, they don't know what to do. The one group is busy saying, give Hussein's child some water. Let this six-month-old have at least a drop of water. The other side of the army, they're just dumbfounded, they're crying, they're not even able to say anything. The third group is the one who actually begins to put a plan into motion. As Harmala is standing there, as the cursed Umar ibn Asad is there, Harmala asks Umar ibn Asad that, what should I do? Umar ibn Asad says, cut the words of this man. As Harmala takes the bow out of his arrow and he puts it within the bow, Harmala asks the commander, he says, should I hit the father or should I hit the son? Should I take this 3-headed arrow and shoot it into the neck of Abu Abdullah, or should I shoot it into the neck of his young little child? Umar ibn Asad replies, of course, shoot the child, kill the father like this. We're told that as Harmala shoots that arrow and it goes into the neck of the young Hazrat Ali Asghar, that the historian said that it goes through one side of the neck, and the neck of the child being as small as it is, it goes all the way through. It goes to the other side of the neck of little Hazrat Ali Asghar. It then pierces into the forearm of Aba Abdullah. The blood begins to pour out from the tiny body of Aba Abdullah. Imam Hussein, what can he do? He walks back and forth. Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. How can he take this baby back to Rabab, knowing that all he wanted was a drink of water, and his thirst was quenched? But it wasn't quenched with the water of the Farat. It was quenched with the blood of his little child, Hazrat Ali Asghar, on the day of Ashura. وَسَيَعْلَمُ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا أَيَّ مُنْقَلِبٍ يَنْقَلِبُونَ إِنَّ لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّ إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. We ask Allah on this 10th after the day of Ashura to accept our act of worship in these nights and days of Muharram. We ask Allah to give us the tawfiq to have the benefit of being at the ziyarat of Aba Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salam. We ask Allah for the ability for us also have the shafa'at of Imam Hussein and the shuhada of Karbala on the day of judgment. We ask Allah to forgive us our sins, to keep us all on the path of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad, and that we have the ability to pay our respects to Sayyidul Shuhada in the land of Karbala. Rabbana taqabbal minna innaka anta as-sami'ul alim. Sallu ala Muhammad.